would, please turn to Exodus chapter 7. Exodus chapter 7. To bring us where we are in our text today, a very brief review. God has called a very flawed man named Moses to lead the nation of Israel up out of Egypt and into the land that was promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And Moses is now the established leader of the nation of Israel, a man who's supposed to have been killed as a baby, but God spared him. In fact, God had placed him in the house of Pharaoh to be raised, and he was trained up in the way of the Egyptians for 40 years. But Moses knew and understood that he was a Hebrew, he was a son of Israel, and he saw the oppression and the wrong that was done to his people, and deciding to take matters into his own hands, out of a good heart, he kills an Egyptian taskmaster and then has to flee from Egypt to the land of Midian. But God had spared him. God gave him a wife, gave him two sons, gave him a father-in-law that even cared for him. And then God reveals himself to Moses in the mountain range of Horeb on what would be called the mountain of God, Mount Sinai. And in the ensuing conversation, God delivers his name. He reveals to Moses his name, the I Am. And he impresses in no small way that he is indeed the covenant God of the fathers of Israel, and that he will rescue his people from bondage, and that he will see them through into the land of promise. He being God, he will do all that he said he would do. And in fact, God was still working, even though the people in bondage couldn't see it. And God then provides Moses with a plan. God provides Moses with signs. God gives Moses a few lessons in authority. God takes Moses through hard providences and again confirms that he, the I Am God, the transcendent God, the one who is above all things, who consists and needs nothing but himself, he's in control of all things, and he will do everything that he said he would do. This transcendent God is not in an upper level of beyond the atmosphere and not in touch with his people. The transcendent God is indeed one who has now condescended to his people. So God's called Moses. He now has his brother Aaron to speak for him. They have confronted Pharaoh. And 2 weeks ago, we looked at what I feel was the equivalent of a boxing ring announcer's saying that the fight's about to start. It's quite the build-up to what God, the God who holds all power, what God tells Moses would be great judgments by his mighty hand upon Pharaoh and the Egyptians. And today we start to see and understand what the judgments are and what they mean. God has told Moses that he is going to make himself known to the Egyptians. And it started by a small demonstration of his power when Aaron, as Moses told him what to do, threw down his staff, which God turned into a snake, and then swallows the other snakes that had been delivered by secret arts through Pharaoh's assembled magicians and wise men. And at the end of that narrative piece, regardless of what was seen there, Pharaoh's heart was simply hardened more, which will be the case on and on, as we will see. And so if you've looked ahead in our text, the sermon title is a rather obvious one, Water Turned to Blood. So we'll start in the last portion of our text, the last time we were together, in chapter 7, verse 8. We'll read through verse 25. Now the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, when Pharaoh speaks to you, saying, work a miracle, then you shall say to Aaron, take your staff and throw it down before Pharaoh that it may become a serpent. So Moses and Aaron came to Pharaoh, and thus they did, just as the Lord had commanded. And Aaron threw his staff down before Pharaoh and his servants, and it became a serpent. Then Pharaoh also called for the wise men and the sorcerers, and they also, the magicians of Egypt, did the same with their secret arts. For each one threw down his staff, and they turned into serpents, but Aaron's staff swallowed up their staffs. Yet Pharaoh's heart was hardened, and he did not listen to them, as the Lord had said. Then the Lord said to Moses, Pharaoh's heart is stubborn. He refuses to let the people go. Go to Pharaoh in the morning as he is going out to the water and station yourself to meet him on the bank of the Nile. And you shall take in your hand the staff that was turned into a serpent. You shall say to him, the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, sent me to you, saying, let my people go, that they may serve me in the wilderness. But behold, you have not listened until now. Thus says the Lord, by this you shall know that I am the Lord. Behold, I will strike the water that is in the Nile with the staff that is in my hand, and it will be turned to blood. And the fish that are in the Nile will die. And the Nile will become foul, and the Egyptians will find difficulty in drinking water from the Nile. And the Lord said to Moses, say to Aaron, take your staff and stretch out your hand over the waters of Egypt, over the rivers, over the streams, and over the pools, and over all the reservoirs of water, that they may become blood. And there will be blood throughout all the land of Egypt, both in the vessels of wood and the vessels of stone. So Moses and Aaron did even as the Lord had commanded. And he lifted up the staff, and he struck the water that was in the Nile in the sight of Pharaoh and in the sight of his servants. And all the water that was in the Nile was turned to blood. The fish that were in the Nile died, and the Nile became foul, so that the Egyptians could not drink water from the Nile. And the blood was through all the land of Egypt. But the magicians of Egypt did the same with their secret arts. And Pharaoh's heart was hardened, and he did not listen to them, as the Lord had said. And then Pharaoh turned and went into his house with no concern even for this. So all the Egyptians dug around the Nile for water to drink, for they could not drink of the water of the Nile. 7 days passed after the Lord had struck the Nile. Father, I ask that you would bless the reading of your word, and I ask you for your help this morning. Ask it for me. Ask it for us as those gathered here. We need you. Please help us. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, we'll look at our text in three sections or headings. And again, it's such a rarity when I come up with things that start with the same letter. So I can't help myself but make a note of that. But we'll look at this in this way, the pattern, the plague, and the purpose with practical applications. A lot of P's there. So the pattern, the plague, the purpose with practical applications. So first is the pattern. Now, as I struggle to find the correct word to alliterate, right, that you have two of them, there's always a third one, it's a struggle. And I settled on pattern really as a way of getting an overview of the plagues, because there's going to be similarities within each of the plagues that'll be repeated almost every time we look at them. And there's going to be differences, and we'll touch on those for sure. But for a moment here, I want to cover some patterns that we see. And first, by answering, what are the plagues? That's got to be answered. The Hebrew word that's been translated as plague is seen for the first time actually in Exodus chapter 11. We don't see it until the last one. And we rightfully call all of them plagues. That's what they are. But the Lord uses it when speaking to Moses about the last event that he will cause, during which the people of God are actually set free. So again, we speak of the plagues as plagues, and rightly so, but what is about to start taking place is not referred to in such a way until the last one. I've just found that quite interesting. But the word means a blow, as in striking another or striking an object. And so the idea is God is striking a blow. He's striking Pharaoh. He's striking the Egyptian people. And he will do so repeatedly. He is causing these plagues to fall upon those people who are not his. He's causing these plagues, striking a blow on those people, and setting apart even further his own people. After all, those that he's striking have enslaved his people. As we spoke about earlier, God calls them judgments, and in chapter 7, verse 4, when Pharaoh does not listen to you, then I will lay my hand on Egypt and bring out my host, my people, the sons of Israel from the land of Egypt by great judgments. So they're called judgments. You want to know what a plague is? It's God rendering judgment upon these people. But they're also called signs and wonders. And we spoke of this when we went through chapter 4. As you may recall, I quoted the commentator Motyer, in a broad sense, a wonder is something that halts people in their tracks, making them stop and stare. And we've all had that situation. Why do you think that a horrific accident on one side of the interstate causes so much carnage on the other side where there is no accident? Because we cannot help but stop and stare, and we're constantly turning and looking, right? Even when you're griping at the people in front of you, what do when you go by it? Yeah. Well, it's a wonder. Like, a wonder is meant to catch our attention. A sign is meant to engage our minds. A wonder astonishes, and a sign instructs, Motyer goes on to say. So they're also that. They're judgments, or signs and wonders. And as we look at each plague, I hope you will see how each of these items are at work within them. God striking the Egyptians with judgment, an event to make them stop, and a moment of awestruck wonder, and then forced to ponder as they are instructed. The same is true for the Israelites that are there, though. See the judgments, awestruck, and ponder, forced to ponder as these Egyptians are forcibly instructed, but there's instruction for the Israelites too. But what are the purposes then? What is the instruction? And we'll look at two purposes later. These are to keep in mind as we go through our text today. One, to show these Hebrew people who have now become a nation, that He is their God. Part of this judgment, these signs and wonders against the Egyptians are designed to show the Hebrews that He's rescuing, I'm God. I am your God, and I am to be trusted. And throughout the narrative of these plagues, many times we'll see God speak, has called men, Moses and Aaron obey, and God does what miraculous thing He said He would do. And what is that for? He's authenticating who He is to His people, as well as the leadership of Moses to His people. There's multiple things at play all throughout this. The second thing is really to show the Egyptian people that He is to be feared. More on this later. And because of those two things, three, to set His people free. I mean, that's kind of the end goal here in a certain sense, is to set His people free for the purpose of worshiping Him, right? And four, these plagues are a direct assault against the false gods of Egypt. I mean, God targets many of their primary gods. It's a direct assault against them. And showing Pharaoh and the people of Egypt that the God of the Hebrews is to be feared, think about this. This is mind-boggling. Think about the God of the people that you have enslaved, that have been here for hundreds of years, that God is the one that you should bow down to. Now think about this from the ideas and the minds of the Egyptian people. Really? God's also utilizing His hand of judgment and bringing about the plague to show He's superior, to reign over all their faults and inept gods. And as a final thought, let's say this about the plagues. There are many, many, many people who've written on the plagues and see them as naturally occurring phenomenon. For instance, I'll give you a flow here, see if you can follow it. The River Nile turning to blood is simply the color red from sediment when the river's at flood stage, which leads to frogs abandoning the river, and they have to live on land, but they have to live on land without the water so that they die, and the flies and the gnats, and you see where I'm going, so on and so forth. But there is a precision in the plagues that doesn't allow for just naturally occurring phenomenon to be the reason behind all this. And to describe it as such is, in reality, by God-fearing people, presumably, to describe it is really just to try to take God out of Scripture. I think it's rather foolish to read these events and see nothing but natural events that are ascribed to God. For sure, God uses the natural, but he does so in a supernatural way. In fact, in Exodus 10, verse 2, God tells Moses that he hardened the heart of Pharaoh and his servants in order to perform these signs. And he says, that you may tell in the hearing of your son and of your grandson how I made a mockery of the Egyptians and how I performed my signs among them, that you may know I am the Lord. Right? Well, he didn't just use natural things and kind of enhance them. No. We'll see as we move along. But he does so you can tell. They can deliver this message down to the children and the grandchildren. We can tell them God made a mockery of these people. They didn't worship him. They hated him. They had enslaved us. And God mocked all that they were holding on to. Everything that made them them. God performed signs that made a mockery of these things. That's not naturally occurring events, is it? So in case there's any wonder, no, they're not. Let me answer that for you. They're not. And God says he made a mockery of. So it's the hand of God striking the Egyptians with things that they had never witnessed in this manner whatsoever. And so we will look at the first of these things now. There's no doubt most of us have heard the stories about the plagues throughout our lives in church. So you may be sitting here going, man, I remember hearing these since I was in K-5. And I can tell you, flannel graph and all, I give away some of my age there. All the stories that we heard. But I'm going to ask you, instead of sitting here with that understanding, I've heard it and I know what we're going to say, this might be a bit agonizing. Instead, I ask you to look at these things as if it's the first time you've heard about the plagues. I ask you to look at this through the eyes of the Egyptians and the Israelites who are there in place watching this to happen. I ask you to look at it through the eyes of the Israelites who would be going into Canaan years later, 40-something years later. These people haven't died. Their children are going into the land of Canaan, hearing this read to them from the pen of Moses the first time after having grown up with these stories all about them. So let's look at the plague. There's two sections here, and the first section in the plague is what God said. What God said about the plague. In verse 14, Pharaoh's heart is stubborn. He refuses to let people go. So go to Pharaoh in the mornings. He's going out to the water and station yourself to meet him on the bank of the Nile. You shall take in your hand the staff that was turned into a serpent. Now, I read the narrative of that earlier so that we would have this fresh in our minds, having been a couple weeks. A sign of the serpent had been demonstrated in front of Pharaoh, and even though the serpent God had made from the staff swallows up and eats up the staffs, the serpents made from the occultists of Egypt, Pharaoh's heart was hardened against the God who had shown himself to be mighty over inanimate objects, such as the stick or the staff. Showed himself to be mighty over the living symbols of power and authority of Egypt, serpents, and dominant over anything that the magicians could do. Even though God had given Pharaoh something to ponder, to think about regarding who he is, Pharaoh was refusing to let the people go. And so God tells Moses, hey, Moses, I want you to go and confront Pharaoh on the bank of the Nile River. Now, as we've stated before, the Nile was the single most important thing in Egypt. Everything that existed in Egypt was because of that river. And we talked about this, I think, even on a Wednesday night, where if you look at a map of Egypt, even today, and you look at what's there, everything centers around the river. It's not a lot that happens in the sand outside of it. So there wouldn't be anything there but desert. It's the source of life for the land and the nation. As a result, Pharaoh, along with his people, worshipped the Nile. Oh, the god of the Nile was a god named Hapi, H-A-P-I, Hapi. He was depicted with the head of a bearded man and a body of a female swollen with the promise of a child to come. What would that be? Why would you come up with that? Well, it's picturing the physical sustenance of the river and the fertility and the sustaining power of the river through this God they worship. One says, Happy's floods, floods of the river, Happy's floods were seen as a renewal, a necessary process for the rebirth of the land each year. Pretty important. Got to make up something to worship, so we're gonna have something symbolize everything, right? Well, archaeologists have discovered quite a bit about the gods of Egypt, including hymns that were sung to the god Happy. Now, they were not happy hymns, like happy. See what I did there? That was pretty sharp. They were not happy hymns in that they were simply repeated dribble that spoke in general terms. Instead, they included, and I quote, lyrics that expressed devotion, gratitude, and requests for protection and guidance. Now think about this. These are the hymns that we've recovered and uncovered that were serious in nature, going to their God Happy for the very things that we as the children of the God should go to Him for. In song, mind you. So to receive such things as devotion, gratitude, protection, and guidance, there were then ongoing rituals and offerings that were also performed throughout the land of Egypt, like in temples or in sacred places. And all this to say this, in our text, we tend to assume that Pharaoh is simply going to the River Nile to bathe. It's more likely that he was going to actually to perform a ritual dedicated to Happy, the god of the Nile. Why wouldn't he? After all, he had just had a previous sign play out in front of him. And with a hard heart towards the god of the Hebrew slaves, why wouldn't Pharaoh seek help from a god of Egypt, a primary god of Egypt, a powerful god of Egypt? And we cannot say with complete certainty that this is the case. But bathing regularly wasn't a thing in that day and age. I had everybody stunk. So nobody knew it. It's okay. They didn't go all the time. But we tend to think of that because we have the scenario of Pharaoh's daughter going to the river to bathe. It could be because of their status. They could have done that regularly. But more than likely, I take it that he was going to perform a ritual on behalf of the god Happy. It had this thing already happened, the symbol of authority and power of God was used to eat up the very serpents that his men had made. So Moses and Aaron were to go to the river and have this and hold the same staff in their hands. I gotta think on their behalf, again, it's God's graciousness to give them again something to hold, the very tangible thing that they can look at and remember. This is what God just did. This was a snake yesterday that ate all kinds of snakes yesterday. This is God symbolizing God's authority and his power. How comforting that must have been. And then God says, tell Pharaoh, the Lord, who is the God of the Hebrew people, has sent me to you. And he says to you, as he has been saying, let my people go that they may serve me in the wilderness. But behold, you've not listened until now. And because of all I'm about to do, you will know that I am the Lord. And Moses is to keep going. I will strike the water that's in the Nile with the staff that's in my hand. It will be turned to blood, and the fish that are in the Nile will die. The Nile will become foul, and the Egyptians will find difficulty in drinking water from the Nile. This sounds bad, but it's not finished. God then says to Moses, tell Aaron to go take the staff they just struck the Nile with and then wave it as if he's waving over all the other waters in the land of Egypt. Tell him that, and they will all become blood, even the water that's been collected in pots and pans and reservoirs, all of it. Right? So this is what God said. This is what he said. That's the first section in the plague. The second section was what was done in the plague. And immediately we see what should be done anytime God tells us to do something. Obedience. So Moses and Aaron did even as the Lord had commanded. These men have learned They learn, at least for a brief time, Aaron particularly, but at least here. So Moses and Aaron did even as the Lord had commanded, and he lifted up the staff and struck the water that was in the Nile in the sight of Pharaoh and in the sight of his servants. Now, I got to be honest with you. If there was a time to question something, maybe this would have been it. Now, bear with me. Who confronts the most powerful man in Egypt? The land that holds all your family. I mean, extended family. Who confronts the most powerful man in Egypt, which happens to be the most powerful nation on the known earth, and then tells him, I'm going to raise a staff in the air, strike the water. When I do, it's going to turn blood. I just think this through logically from the people that are there. Does this make any sense whatsoever? Do you think it looked crazy to those among whom they were standing, confronting and speaking with to do what God's told them to do? I mean, yeah. I mean, when we think about it and pull ourselves back, it even sounds crazy to us. Nevertheless, Moses and Aaron did even as the Lord commanded. And all the water that was in the Nile was turned to blood. It's obvious here that Aaron also lifted his staff up because, you know, over all the other waterways and all the water storage places, because God did exactly what he said he would do. The fish that were in the Nile died. The Nile became foul. The Egyptians could not drink the water from the Nile, and the blood was to all the land of Egypt. Oh, this was pervasive. The fish died just like God said they would in verse 18. The Nile became foul just like God said it would in verse 18. Egyptians couldn't drink from the Nile just as God said. It's almost like God does, every single time God does what he said he's going to do. But the magicians of Egypt did the same with their secret arts. And Pharaoh's heart was hard, and he did not listen to them, as the Lord said. Now, let me ask you a question. If the magicians and sorcerers of Egypt could do mighty deeds, mighty works, what would make the most sense to do in a situation? Wouldn't it be to turn the water that's now been turned into blood back into water? If you think about this, if I'm going to show myself more powerful than the God of the Egyptians or God of the Hebrews, and he's just done this to these two knuckleheads, why can't I take, well, we should just be able to turn. Instead, what does it say? They didn't. I don't think we get how paralyzing this event was when we look at it. I thought about it for a while. I thought, well, maybe if I used a local example, like the Ocmulgee River, one of my favorite rivers in the world, right? If I used that and it turned into blood, everything that would be catastrophic. There's a lot of rock bass in that river, and I would hate for them to all die. That would be upsetting to me, but that doesn't help us understand the nature of it. I thought maybe if I used the Mississippi. And I thought, we're too far removed from the Mississippi even. I don't know that we'll get that. And I thought maybe the best example or best way to understand how this, or we can relate to it, is if God told Moses and Aaron to, in the United States, mind you, to tell the president that if we didn't let go of his people so they could serve and worship him because we've been holding on to him for hundreds and hundreds of years, if we didn't let his people go so they could serve and worship him, that he'd raise a staff over all the land of the United States of America, and when they struck the ground, all the power would disappear. All power. Not just the main power lines, but everything that comes off of transmission lines. Everything goes. All power shut down. And then Aaron would raise the staff again, and the power that's provided by all battery and solar and wind, other such systems would also fail. Put in perspective of what's taking place here. Can you imagine the things that would go foul as a result? I mean, have you ever lost one freezer full of venison. That's some rank stuff. You ever lost a freezer full that had fish in it? That's bad. You ever come home from somewhere and the power had gone out or the refrigerator had died and you open it, the refrigerator after being closed for 3-4 days with no power? I mean, that's just stinking. Now, we think about the Nile going foul. That's the entire system of life is now in blood. Now, blood itself smells bad if you've ever smelled any. But a river full of blood with dead fish in it too? I just think, we think about these things and the inconveniences and the lack of all the things that's provided for us today by power, lights. Just having no lights. You think about that. It's crazy. Air conditioning in July and August. Gone. Refrigeration. We've talked about. Internet. Oh, my goodness gracious. We would not be able to function whatsoever. The internet's down. We might have to read in the daylight. That's crazy, isn't it? But even more important, financial institutions. You can't get your cash. It's all locked up behind things that are electric and electronic, which you can't get to because the power's down and has been for some time. Think about all the turmoil that would create. I promise you, our nation's enemies have, right? Think about these things. I think this is better. But for us to understand, and what if there are a couple ways to get some spotty power, like working really hard, but doing some things underground? Or what if there was a location within the nation where there was a little some power there? Because it was the people that God was saying to be set free. This is where they were located, and they still had power. Now, I say all this to go, well, now we have a group of men that are sent by the government who utilize their secret arts, and to display their power, all they did was turn off more of the power that they found. Follow me? The sorcerers of Egypt could only make this terrible thing worse, but they couldn't fix the problem. They couldn't reverse what God had done. But because these magicians and sorcerers can turn water into blood, Pharaoh goes, yeah, I'm going to harden my heart more. In fact, it says he went to his house not even concerned. That's got to be a very hard fella. He does this as the Lord said. Now, illustration aside, where did those guys get the water to turn into blood? Because everything was already blood. And I do believe they went to the land of Goshen where the Hebrews were allocated to stay. They got water there. It's stated very plain, the distinction, later. It's not stated plainly in here, but I think it's implied. Verse 18, the Nile will become foul and the Egyptians will find difficulty. It didn't say Egyptians and Hebrews, it says only Egyptians. And it's realized in verse 21, the Nile became foul, so the Egyptians could not drink water from the Nile. So I believe they went to where the Hebrews were, that were untouched by this plague, retrieve water, turn it into blood. Powerful, yes, but limited. And it was used by God in the hardening of Pharaoh's heart. Meanwhile, the rest of the Egyptians were busy digging in areas around the Nile to get water, presumably relying upon sand and rock to filter to the water that was now blood so it would become somewhat palatable. We've all seen those stories where we've participated in such things where we have events where there's bad water or brackish water and you go to the a sandbar off to the side of a waterway and dig down. And we can get water with the sand filters. So it doesn't make it perfect, but it makes it better. It makes it something we could actually drink without getting sick. Most of you are not outdoor enthusiasts to such a degree, but you might watch it and see it on something like Bear Grylls or something, some show. But it says they were digging around the river. Well, that's what they were doing. They were digging to find water that was underground. That was better. But how hard this whole thing must have been. What a blow against Pharaoh. What a strike against Happy, the god of the Nile, who's now shown to be powerless.